Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
So, hello Felicity, how are you? I hope all's good in your world.
Everything is good. It's springtime and it's warmed up. It couldn't be better.
Yes. So please do update us with the wonderful world of Felicity travel and your glamorous lifestyle since we last spoke.
My glamorous lifestyle. Well, I'll tell you what happened recently. My oven door exploded.
No, that's not glamorous at all. And that's really scary. What happened?
Well, I was in the lounge room and I was waiting for some vegetables to roast and I heard this explosion and I discovered my kitchen was covered in glass.
Oh my goodness me, that's really scary. So were you hurt?
No, my credit cards hurt. So can I just rant for a second?
Yeah, okay, go on.
Okay, so I've got a standard size built-in European oven that's got a separate cooktop. And the thing is about built-in ovens is it doesn't matter what features they've got, they're pretty much all the same in terms of dimensions.
Okay, so go on.
So what happened is the front glass must have got some sort of crack in it, maybe from the one time that I cleaned it. And over time, the heating and cooling weakened the glass until it finally exploded. Now, I looked this up on Reddit and apparently it's a known problem.
Okay, so it's not known to me. So that sounds quite scary and actually quite worrying. So did you clean the oven really hard then to get the crack in it?
Well, if you're only going to do it once in a decade, you've got to put some elbow grease into it. Anyway, the point being that despite the fact that everything I've got is a standard size, I couldn't replace the door, which would be the obvious thing. And so although it's just 7 years old, that particular model is no longer made.
Of course, of course. So you then, of course, ended up having to buy a new oven.
Well, I didn't just have to buy a complete new oven. I had to buy a separate cooktop, despite the fact that the cooktop is not connected and it's in great condition. Mm. So whatever the new oven is won't sort of match up to it.
Okay, so that sounds stupid expensive.
Yeah, but the thing that annoys me is it's so wasteful. No wonder the planet is burning up. There should be some rule. Okay, this is if I was in charge and I was a dictator.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's my rule. These kinds of appliances have to be universally connectable so that, you know, people don't throw away a perfectly serviceable thing, especially when the different components have heavy metals in them and can only be recycled with enormous difficulty, if at all.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so at the risk of adding to your misery, Felicity, I want to remind you that you'd promised to do new drinks trialing for your podcast homework.
Oh, below the belt. I've got a tragedy here and you're...
Okay.
You're giving me work to do.
Yeah, okay. But before you try and wriggle out of it, the good news is that we have it recorded for posterity on our previous episodes of this very same podcast. So if I recall, you've been promising for a while to try a pint of Guinness and just an FYI, you promised that on episode 5 and this is now episode 10.
Oh, I thought you'd forgotten about this and here you are bringing it up again.
Okay, yes. So your excuse every week, as we remember, because we've all heard it, is that you live in a country town in Germany that doesn't have Guinness and that when you leave said town, you forget.
Which is absolutely true.
Yeah. But I'm going to stop you right there. We've established in the previous episodes also that I monitor our inbox.
Yeah, but don't tell me that people are actually writing in about my non-consumption of Guinness.
Well, actually, yes. So we, if you remember, we had a comment from a listener, Benj, on LinkedIn.
Oh, gosh.
And he said that he was refusing to listen to any more episodes until you confirmed.
Can we just lie?
No, no, that you confirmed that you would try Guinness. But Felicity, let me present you with further evidence. Although I feel that now I'm sounding like I'm a bit of a character in a really bad police crime show. Anyway, Exhibit 1, received in our inbox on the 19th of April.
What? Somebody actually wrote about this.
Oh, yes. So the email reads, quote, I've just finished listening to the episode on Prosecco and I must say it was excellent. I really loved it. Great narration on Felicity's part and great backup with the data from you, Lulu.
This, of course, is absolutely true.
Yeah. So let me continue. Quote, however, there's always something coming after
there's
that.
There's always a but.
However, they say, I notice Felicity still hasn't tried Guinness. What a travesty. Here's a little known fact. there's an Irish-themed pub that served Guinness precisely 210 metres from Felicity's front door.
Do you know what? There is only one person in this world who not only knows about the pub, but who is anally retentive enough to have looked up the distance on Google Maps, and I know his name.
Okay, so the email finishes. Don't fall for her flimsy subterfuge. She's a 3-minute walk from completing her mission. So it continues. I hope you make good use of this information because clearly they know I'll be seeing the email, not you.
Yes. And did this anonymous rat have the courage to sign his name?
Well, it finished saying, signed, quote, a totally anonymous person. So your reaction to the evidence, Ms. Carter?
It's this, he'll get his. By the way, I wouldn't call it an Irish-themed pub, but as it happens, it is a famous pub he's talking about. It used to be a communist haunt back in the 1930s. Okay. So the communists used to go and get drunk there, and then they'd have street fights with the fascist supporters who were drinking a few streets away.
Okay, so why haven't you gone and had a Guinness?
Oh, look, it's a long, long story involving village politics, and if I find the right person to come with me, I will go and do it. Right, so now I'm going to move the subject back to you, Luli. Oh, okay. What have you been up to?
Well, I tried a new drink. Well, actually new to me anyway.
Oh, actually, I can't imagine there's a drink that's new to you. Is this going to be your next Christmas tree drink?
No. Well, actually, I hadn't thought about that. Actually, now you're making me think. Okay, so I'm not sure how to say this without sounding really quite pretentious, but I'll risk it. So when I was in Manhattan recently, I rounded off the trip before I headed back out to the airport with this, get this, me being experimental, a lavender matcha margarita.
A lavender matcha margarita in Manhattan. Okay, so for some reason, that actually doesn't surprise me as much as you might think, because for some reason I've been seeing lavender flavour popping up everywhere. So Smirnoff launched a lavender lemonade RTD in Australia early last year. And at the time I thought that was weird. So I looked it up and apparently it's part of a trend to use florals and botanicals to sort of tone down the bitterness of spirits like gin. So you are bang on trend. Though the combination of matcha and lavender slightly surprises me.
Yeah, so one of the reasons I ordered the cocktail in particular was because I've seen lots and lots in the sort of trends forecast research recently about pistachio, so foods that then end up being green. And this has been particularly influenced by the pistachio Dubai chocolate.
Do you know what? I actually know about this once. I don't usually know about food trends, but one of my friends is the food editor of a major newspaper and she told me about it when it first happened. And then from about 3 weeks from that conversation, suddenly it was everywhere.
Yeah. So perhaps we should explain what this is. So it originates from the luxury chocolate makers, as the name suggests, who are based in Dubai. And it's a combination of pistachio cream, so hence the green bright colour. Now I'm going to butcher this pronunciation as I always do. Kataffi, which is the shredded kataffi. Anyway, the shredded crispy pastry bit and tahini. And it's all encased in milk chocolate. So you get sort of chocolate, creamy, crunchy textures all together. And why this has exploded globally? Well, like many trends in food and drink, it was TikTok.
Okay, I should have guessed.
Yeah. So in this case, it was the TikTok influencer Maria Vera's video with her sampling the chocolate, and it got over 125 million views in 2024.
Okay, so dare I ask, 125 million views, what was she doing to get this amount of views?
Okay, so like most of her posts, she's sitting in a car. She shows you the packaging, typically of sort of luxury or indulgent food products. And then she proceeds to eat it and she doesn't say anything. So she just eats the food, shall we? I'm trying to put this delicately, shall we say, with appreciation.
I see. And she blew up a whole food subcategory from doing that.
Yep. But you'll be pleased to know, Felicity, that Lidl, because I know you've confessed to being a very keen Lidl shopper in the past.
Yeah, me and Lidl are good.
Yeah. Has introduced its own version of the Dubai-style pistachio chocolate bar, and it's only €4.99. time. But it was so popular when they launched it that you may have trouble getting your hands on some.
In fact, I did see it in Lidl, but it's no longer there. And I think one of the reasons it's no longer there is because a lot of chocolate has actually disappeared from the shops because the price of cocoa has gone up so much.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm actually seeing a lot of chocolate substitutes everywhere. Anyway, so go back to the lavender matcha margarita in Manhattan.
Yeah. So there's a sentence. Mm-hmm. So yes. So green drinks, so not like green juice, but drinks, particularly cocktails that are green, are trending at the moment. And as you say, lavender is a trending flavour.
Yeah, if I have the opportunity, I'll try it. But generally, I find that floral tastes are a bit overwhelming for me, and I find them just a bit kitschy, particularly if they're very aromatic, like roses.
Yeah, I've got the same view as you, particularly lavender, because for me that feels really kind of connected to fabric conditioner or hand soap, and so not necessarily flavors I'd want to have or think about having in food or drink. But let me tell you, my matcha lavender margarita was actually rather delicious.
Okay, so you recommend it.
Yeah, so what was really interesting was that the more savoury bitter notes that you could say coming from the matcha were actually really well balanced with the creamy style topping of the cocktail, which had the lavender scent in it.
So what I'm seeing here is a Christmas that's purple and green. I think there's a... I think I can see your lounge room happening. Yeah. Okay, so that's months away. But until then, what are we discussing this week, Luli?
Okay, so this week's question comes from me.
Well, fair enough. I guess if I was allowed to have my Prosecco rant, which apparently was very, very good, you are from...
from an anonymous source.
Yeah, from an anonymous source. You are allowed to ask a question.
Okay, thank you. So this stems from the fact that last week I had the pleasure of attending the diploma graduation ceremony at the historic Guildhall in London for the WSET, the Wine and Spirits Education Trust.
And we should remind everybody that you were not a candidate. You are, in fact, a trustee of the WSET.
Absolutely correct. So there were 809 new diploma graduates honoured at the event this year, and that's the highest number in WSET's history. So it included graduates from 46 countries coming from six continents, and they were studying at 37 different WSET course providers.
Okay. Yeah, the WSET is a fantastic organisation. When I did it, I found their approach to tasting absolutely revelatory. Mm. So before I did their course, I used to flounder around hoping that I'd build some sort of magic palate memory that never came. But their system actually gave me a logical pathway into tasting, which I appreciated.
Yeah. And clearly I'm biased, but I also agree it's a wonderful organisation. And we can come on to discuss in a moment, if that's okay, the systematic approach to tasting that you've just referred to there, that the WSET developed. But we're not the only ones who think that WSET and indeed education in wine is good, because as evidenced by WSET, there are a growing number of people doing wine qualifications at WSET and others at all levels. So sitting there at the graduation, it made me think about, and I was reflecting on, why is wine education growing so fast?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic actually, and I've got some questions of my own. And one of my questions is why so many people are not only signing up for wine education, but why some of the courses out there, and here I'm not talking about the WSET, some of them are actually almost seem they've been created to be impossible to pass, and yet people line up to do them. But okay, if we're going to get into this, we have to be serious and we should outline our conflicts of interest. Yeah, because we do have conflicts of interest in this. So you're a trustee of the WSET. Do you lecture anywhere or have any other educational roles?
Yeah, so correct. I am a trustee of WSET. I also teach as a guest lecturer on a number of wine business programs. So, for example, the Wine MBA in Trieste. And over a number of years, I've taught on other programs in France and Australia and Chile and the US. But those are more the sort of MBA business style degrees. Also, in full disclosure, while we're on it, I've also supported a number of MW candidates with their research papers, and I've also supervised dissertations for the OIV Masters in Wine Business.
Okay, so when I said conflicts of interest, that is the definition. All right, and what wine education have you done?
Okay, so really big confession, which I'm now might live to regret. I haven't done any formal wine product education.
No, I That's amazing. Of all the things that, you know, I was expecting you to say, that's not one of them. Okay.
I know. So I did do my spirits and beer more recently. So does that count?
Hey, all these people who get you to come and, you know, lecture at their wine MBA courses, do they know how utterly unqualified you are?
that's low, Felicity. That's really low. No, so my
education levels are slipping. It's true what they say. Okay, I'm sorry. It's a joke. Carry
as on. You well know, Felicity, my area is not on product expertise, but is on the business strategy and marketing.
Okay. Yes, in that case, you're extremely consumers. Qualified.
Yeah, so I do think about doing the diploma, actually, in all seriousness, but it takes around 2 years to complete, and, you know, being the highest ranking award that WSET offers, so it's a really big commitment.
Yeah, no, it is. Okay, so unlike you, I've done the WSET level 3.
Oh, show off, why don't you?
Well, I actually did it. I wasn't planning on doing it, but I did it years ago when somebody I was friendly with happened to be running it for their company, and they asked me if I wanted to tag along for free.
Okay, well, that sounds quite good. So you did it in London?
No, it was in Warsaw in late autumn, so it was okay. Very grey. So I spent 1 week in a very sterile Airbnb. And anyway, the company sent me the study book in advance with a note saying I needed to read the book before turning up.
Yes, which is what the WSET do, so which you did, of course.
No, I didn't. Oh. I thought, hey, I've been a wine magazine editor for 9 years now. I don't need to read the book.
Yeah. So you found it incredibly easy then?
No, by the end of the first hour, it was clear to me that I should have read the book. I was in such a panic about it because, you know, there's an exam at the end of the 5 days.
Yeah, I know. And there's a lot of material that you need to cover. So what did you do?
Okay, so I had the benefit of growing up with an aunt who was a psychologist at a university, and she was an expert in methods of learning. And she told me that the more you could get your different senses involved in learning, the more you would fix things into your memory. So she said you should talk to yourself, or you should sing the material to yourself, or, you know, and you should move. So I spent every night in a Polish Airbnb drawing maps in the air, talking to myself, singing bits of information about the Loire Valley. And I think I even did a tap dance over an imaginary map of Tuscany. It worked well enough to get me over the line.
Oh my God, I'm just hoping that that wasn't one of the Airbnbs that had one of those hidden cameras.
Yeah, that's right. Oh my God. Probably was.
Anyway, sounds like quite a handy aunt to have had.
Well, you'd think so, except that when she was doing research, she used to come and visit, and she'd treat us as guinea pigs and do psychological tests on us. And before you say it, yes, it explains a lot.
So were you tempted after that to move on to the diploma level, so the top level?
Well, I actually got offered a scholarship to do it. And I made the mistake of telling a colleague who shall remain nameless, and he promptly said, quote, "You have to be really bright to do that." So I dropped the idea immediately.
Okay. So Felicity, I'm going to say something nice about you now. So as your friend and colleague, I think that's really, really rough, because I would put you up there as in the really bright category.
Thank you, Lily. Thank you so much.
I'm actually saying something nice for a change. Anyway, it's a shame that comment put you off. Are you ever going to think about doing any more wine education?
Well, you know, now I think if I just... Oh, he also added, and it's a lot of work, and maybe it was that put me off.
Okay.
Now I think, actually, if I'd done it, it would have been 10 years ago and I would have had the qualification by now. But no, I actually decided a long time ago that my job as a journalist is to know enough to ask the right questions, but that I don't need to be an expert myself. So that sort of worked in good stead. Mm. But what about you? I know you did the spirits and beer course through WSET. So what's next for you?
Well, I'd actually quite like to move on to the level 2 in spirits. I really enjoy doing the spirits course and learned a lot from it. But actually, I think what I'd rather do is move towards a PhD, which I've always wanted to do.
But that would be in
wine business and consumer behavior, so that's kind of my area.
Okay.
Anyway, so talking of academics, I know you've also done some teaching.
Yes, well, I spent some time last year working on Arena Global's research into wine education, mm-hmm. which was really about how to mix wine knowledge with business skills. Mm. It's a very interesting project, and I've just become a guest lecturer at the Business School at the University of Cape Town. I did my first lecture a couple of weeks ago, which I really enjoyed.
Well, that's amazing. So what were you lecturing on?
Storytelling, but how it can be applied in a practical way to wine branding. So I should also add my other conflict of interest, which is I've recently done some work for Wine Scholar Guild, which is a fantastic private organisation founded 20 years ago that's aimed at enthusiasts rather than trade people. And they also are seeing explosive growth.
They're a great outfit. So they're growing to the WSET.
Yeah, they can't keep up with the demand. Anyway, so that brings me to the question I touched on earlier. I know this is your question podcast, but what I keep hearing from people across the board is that not only are more and more interested people signing up for wine education, but they keep signing up for courses that are extremely difficult. And if they fail them, they go back and have another go. It's amazing.
Okay, yeah. So I might have one answer to that, or one thought anyway about that. So one of my favourite frameworks that also applies here regarding the desire to do education when it's optional. So we're talking about optional education here as opposed to compulsory. So, for example, the stuff we have to do at school.
Okay, tell me more.
Okay. So I actually learned about this, ironically, when I was doing a course myself about 6 years ago. So kind of illustrating the point that I'm about to make.
Okay, do tell.
Okay, so the framework's called the Human Givens, and it was developed actually in the UK by two people working in psychology and psychotherapy, so Joe Griffin and Ivan Tyrrell in the 1990s. And it's centred around the fact that humans are born, they say, with a set of innate emotional and physical needs, hence the givens, and that we also have a set of resources to help meet those needs. So when those needs are met and therefore we're in balance, we experience good mental health and well-being. But when they're not, we experience emotional distress.
Oh, okay. So it's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And that's the idea that you satisfy your bodily needs first and then you start tackling psychological ones.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, sort of. So just bear with me. So the Human Givens framework suggests there are a number of emotional needs hardwired into all humans, regardless of our culture and our background. So these include at the most primary level, as you were saying, kind of security, safety, and free from fear. So the Human Givens mirrors Maslow in that sense, as you were just talking about there. So where he suggested that the first order needs of human beings include basic survival, so food, water, warmth, followed by safety needs, so security, safety and health.
Okay, so how does this link to education?
Okay, so in both cases, so in Maslow's hierarchy and the Human Givens, they both suggest that the higher order needs of human beings include esteem, what they call esteem needs. So in the case of Maslow, there are needs in us as human beings for achievement, confidence and status. And in the case of the Human Givens, these are expressed as human needs, which include status. So this is saying we as humans thrive better when we have status. So a sense of social value and respect. We thrive better when we're part of community or communities. So we feel connected to others. And we thrive better when we have a sense of competence and achievement. So feeling capable and achieving things. So this is why I think lots of people, particularly as adults, embark on education. It's stemming from our need as human adults to feel like we're developing status, achievement, and improving ourselves. So yes, we might undertake education for direct work purposes. So, you know, like to qualify as an accountant or lawyer, for example. But in the case of wine education, I wonder if actually the key motivations for lots of people are more driven from the self-actualization esteem needs.
Well, actually, I have a theory about wine education and status needs.
Okay. So you're not going to say something about being wine snobby, are you?
No. I'm actually thinking about the concept of cultural capital. When I was growing up, which is a while ago now, a lot of cultural capital accrued to people who knew things about the arts, like classical music, art and literature.
Yeah, but isn't there still a lot of cultural capital in those things today?
No, I don't think there is. Mm, so you might have read Ulysses or War and Peace, but nobody cares the way they do, you know, they might have 30 years ago. From what I see today, the cultural capital involves food and wine. So I know among people I know that are sort of upper middle class that cooking to restaurant standard is almost mandatory among a certain type of sophisticated urban dweller.
And you think that's different from the past?
Very much so. So when I was growing up, somebody's mum might have made a nice dinner, but I don't remember anybody's mother throwing together some astonishing dish involving caramelised sardines or something the way that so many people do casually today.
Okay, well, one, I don't like sardines, so that wouldn't work for me.
How bourgeois.
Back to my question. So why do you think that's changed?
Well, I think food has become so much more important, but I think we've missed a step. So Let me just outline the key wine education bodies, and I'll just focus on those that teach wine itself rather than winemaking or viticulture or the wine business courses. So let's set the scene. So there's the Wine and Spirits Education Trust, obviously, which started as a trade qualification, but which now attracts plenty of enthusiastic amateurs. As I mentioned, there's Wine Scholar Guild, which offers in-depth knowledge of France, Spain, Italy and Germany, and also immersive wine tour, but again, it's solely for enthusiasts. Mm-hmm. There's the Master of Wine, another London institution, which is the most coveted qualification that sits above the WSET diploma. And then there are lots of courses run by regional bodies such as the Vanishley International Academy, which is another incredibly tough course. But why don't you talk a bit about the WSET?
Okay, so the WSET was founded in 1969 in London, which makes it exactly the same age as me. There you go, there's a coincidence. So it was founded as a charitable trust to meet the growing educational needs of the UK wine and spirits industry, as there was a need identified for standardised formal training for professionals.
So if somebody was identifying that, who was it that was founding it?
Okay, so the founding organisations that built the WSET and actually who still have representatives serving on its board of trustees today were the Worshipful Company of Vintners, which we've spoken about
name.
Before. Yeah, remember, I'm a liveryman of the Worshipful Company of Vintners. Felicity will have nothing said against them. So they were one of the four founding organisations, along with the Wine and Spirit Association of Great Britain, known now as the Wine and Spirit Trade Association, the WSTA. The third institution was the Institute of Masters of Wine, the IMW, and the fourth institution was the Worshipful Company of Distillers.
I would never laugh at that name. I think that sort of hangover from the medieval world is charming.
Oh, thank you. And as are our medals that we talked about before, and I'm very proud of my medal. Anyway, so although the WSET was created by these four trade bodies sort of coming together to get this professionalisation of education in wine and spirits, there were also individuals who had a significant impact. And they included people like the late, great Michael Broadbent, MW, who was a strong advocate for professionalism of wine education, and his influence on tasting methodology help shape the ethos that you were talking about earlier, actually, for the WSET systematic approach to tasting.
It's interesting. So I guess we should say that these qualifications were created and still are for individuals working in the wine and spirits trade.
Correct. But like with many good things, Felicity, the demand grew for this type of structured education outside of the UK as wine and spirits professionals around the world saw the benefit of these qualifications. So in 1977, the WSET expanded internationally for the first time. So it launched courses in the Republic of Ireland and also the first course in North America, which was actually in Ontario, Canada.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So by 2007, for the first time, the number of international candidates taking WSET exams surpassed the number in the UK.
So how did they do it? Did they just keep opening international offices everywhere?
No. So the way the WSET is structured then and continues to be today, so that they can now deliver courses in 70 countries, is that individuals and training providers, such as wine schools, can apply to deliver the WSET courses, and they're known as APPs, Approved Program Providers. So you have to pass an exam to become a certified WSET education provider.
Okay. Anything else?
So today the WSET qualifications, as I said, are available in 70 countries, 15 languages, and now 75% of students studying are outside of the UK.
Yeah, the other educational body that came out of London is, of course, the Institute of Masters of Wine, which also now has students all over the world. But because of that and the WSET's international reach, you could actually say that the global approach to wine education has been set by Britain. Mm. It's a reminder that at one time London was the centre of the global wine trade.
Yeah, and that trade history is key. So I spoke to Ian Harris. So he is the former CEO of the WSET. And I spoke to him because he was leading the business when they had that really kind of strong 20-year growth and particularly global growth and expansion that we were talking about. And interestingly, he said that he viewed a key benefit of the WSET education is it adds value and profit to drinks businesses.
Yeah, and this is the key. So the wine education bodies started as a way of enhancing a business by training its teams. In the case of wine, beer or spirits, which is quite different to the human need of status, achievement and community that we were talking about, but which is now driving a lot of wine education.
Yeah. So I also checked in with the wonderful Carolyn, who is the marketing director currently at WSET, about what types of people are now doing WSET courses. So there are about 130,000 people across the world who participate in WSET courses every year.
That is enormous. I had no idea it was that big. If you'd asked me, I would have said probably 20% of that. So of that, how many of them are trade only?
Well, that's really interesting. So currently, 46% of candidates work in the trade, which we do our maths, Felicity, and that leaves just over half of those candidates globally who do not work in the drinks industry.
So that's about 60,000 people a year who are doing qualifications just basically for their own interest.
Absolutely. Yeah. So when I did my level one beer course, WSET beer course recently, which if you remember, it's because I was doing my homework for the Guinness episode.
Yes,
just pointing that out.
Yeah.
So in my class, interestingly, in my class, there were a father and son combo who were absolutely lovely. And neither of them worked in the beer industry. And they'd been given the course as a joint Christmas present as they were both big beer fans and the gift giver thought they'd enjoy doing the course together, which, by the way, they did.
Yeah, so I suppose in theory that supports the idea of taking education for reasons like community, bond building, achievement, status. But how interesting that they chose this rather than, I don't know, whatever it is that blokes normally do. I mean, men have always loved beer, but going off to do a course in connoisseurship is quite new. And this is sort of ties into what I was saying, which is I think that knowing about food and wine and beer and spirits is a new form of cultural capital.
Yeah, so I also checked in with Carrie, an amazing lady. So she is not working in the drinks industry. So she actually founded and is CEO of an organization called Cruxy. And that's a business that supports B2B tech companies to grow primarily through implementing smarter pricing strategies. So she's not wine trade, but she has done level WSET wine level 2 and 3. So I asked Carrie why she did the courses. And she said that she wanted to get greater sort of foundation level of wine knowledge. She wanted to learn more about wine. She wanted to learn how better to invest in wine. And most importantly, she wanted to just enjoy it, the sort of pleasure of doing the courses. She said that the best thing she got out of it was developing a backbone of information, which she now falls back on when she's choosing or drinking or investing in wine.
Yeah, I tell you what's interesting is how many women I've spoken to are signing up for the WSET or something similar because they're executives and they need to navigate the wine list when they go out with clients, or just because it's something they feel that they should know. It's becoming a very important form of knowledge.
Yeah. So Carrie, let me just, she is an amazing, strong, determined, self-driven, hugely successful career lady. And yet doing the courses, she said, sort of helped her build her confidence with wine. So she also went on to say that one of the best things about the WSET course actually was meeting some other wonderful people on the course, which I guess kind of loops back to that idea I was talking about in the human givens principle, that we feel better as human beings when we have a sense of community around us.
Do you think the WSET have got any statistics on how many people get married as a result of going on doing the wine course together?
I don't know.
So, all right. So do you know how many people study courses like Carrie did? I bet you know that one.
Well, I do. So in terms of wine versus beer and spirits, so we've been talking about that. I know, again, thanks to the lovely Carolyn at WSET, 88% of the courses currently done by the 130,000 students globally are in wine, and the rest is split between spirits, beer and sake. So top three countries, Felicity, for WSET in terms of candidate numbers. What's your guess?
Well, I'm going to say number one is still going to be the UK. Mm-hmm. And I would bet you that number two is the USA. But the third one, I don't know. Is China still in the running? I mean, I knew they were a very major market back in wine boom times, but the market has... It's not as exciting as it was.
Yep. So you're absolutely spot on. Well done. Three out of three. So UK, US, and third one, China. And we were talking, you mentioned about gender or about women, more women taking on WSET courses. So I checked in on that one as well. And actually, it's a 50-50% even split for male and female candidates globally for WSET now.
That's interesting. All right. So it sounds like we're running a promo for WSET. Yes. So should we probably move on and talk about some of the other wine education courses?
Yeah, we absolutely should. But before we do that, can I just add one more comment?
You can, yes.
Okay. So thank you. So the course, I think what I'm finding really interesting is the course that's had the biggest sort of year-on-year growth, so proportional growth, is actually the highest level course, which is the wine diploma, which is the trickiest one.
That is really interesting. I mean, that sort of goes with what I've been observing, which is the number of people who are signing up for these really, really difficult things. I mean, it's not just 2 years, it's a significant financial investment as well, which is a great segue into talking about the Master of Wine, because you need the diploma before you can apply for the MW course.
It is. So take it away, Felicity. Tell us all things MW and, of course, your opinions as well, please.
Yeah, I have opinions, right?
I know you do.
So I'll just tell you a bit about the MW first. It's another post-war institution founded in 1955 with the goal of elevating the wine trade. Now, why do you think it was in the 1950s rather than before or after, given that the wine trade in Britain has been significant for centuries?
Well, given that date, I'm guessing that has something to do with the war.
Correct. So during the Second World War, alcohol was very tightly controlled by the government, as you can imagine. Mm. But then Britain paid a very high price for the war, and the economy didn't really recover until the mid-1950s.
Yeah, well, you have to remember in context of that, there was still rationing in England, in Britain in 1954.
Yeah, that's right. But as the economy recovered and sort of trading conditions normalised, more wine began to enter the UK. So all of a sudden, there was a need for more wine professionals. So this is where the Worshipful Company of Vintners, I love that.
Thank you.
And the Wine and Spirit Association of Great Britain, which were then the key bodies, worked together to develop an exam to test wine knowledge. So the first exam took place in 1953, and then they realised they needed an official body to oversee it, and hence they founded the Institute of Masters of Wine, which in those days had just 16 founding members.
And back then, it was all men, I am guessing, and all British.
Yes, and that stayed that way until the 1980s. I mean, there were women much earlier, but the first non-Brit was an Australian, Michael Hill Smith. And today there are close to 500 MWs, and they come from more than 30 countries. So achieving the MW remains the Mount Everest of wine. Until recently, it only had a pass rate of about 10%.
Okay, so I know an opinion is on its way, Felicity.
Yeah, so I want to tell you a story. So about 15 years ago, this is when I was editor of Meininger's Wine Business International, I was reading about MBAs and about how you rank MBAs. So MBAs get ranked by things like how much their graduates earn, how sought after the graduates are, and sort of that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly, which kind of makes a lot of sense but for MBAs. So where are you going with this one?
Okay, so I thought what I'd do is I would write a story about the MW, and I would try and find out how much it costs to do and then what happened to you when you graduated. Did your earnings suddenly go up? Did you suddenly get a better job? I thought that would be really interesting.
Yes, it is really interesting, but I'm guessing that's quite a tough thing to do. So
it turned
what did
out
you
to
find
be,
out?
Yes, it turned out to be a surprisingly difficult topic to research. I was really surprised. So people just wouldn't talk to me on the record. But off the record, I heard so many stories about tens of thousands of dollars being spent on samples and travels, if not six figures.
Wow.
But after people had spent all this money and they were obsessed with studying, they couldn't pass. It had this really dismal pass rate, but people couldn't predict whether they were going to pass or fail.
Yeah, so I'm wondering then whether that's part of the prestige and the status that we were talking about earlier. just in this case because it's so hard to get?
Well, it is, you know, and that's why so many people want to do it. But, you know, think about higher education. So I actually looked this up at the time. Stanford University teaches both brain surgery and rocket science, which are, you know, the byword for difficult things, or as they would call it, neurosurgery and astronautics.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But their pass rate is 94%. And I cannot believe that a wine qualification is more complicated and difficult than neurosurgery. So I wondered, why does it have such a high fail rate?
Okay, so what was your theory?
Well, I don't know, and I never proved this, but my thinking was that either the pedagogy, the teaching method, was problematic, or the admissions process was a problem in that they were probably admitting the wrong people.
Okay, so they're pretty clear that it's a self-study course and you do have to have done the diploma, so you kind of had to prove that you can get to a certain and quite high level of study and you have to apply to the course.
Yeah, but it's still a qualification, so you'd think there'd be a clear pathway to getting it. But I will say the international nature of it may have been problematic. One of the things that really surprised me was how many Europeans who told me they didn't understand the English essay writing system. Now, that's not the fault of the Institute. I was gobsmacked to learn that essay writing is not a feature of many European education systems.
Yeah, and I've definitely come across that when I've been teaching on kind of wine business and wine MBA programs. I've really seen that the sort of traditional British form of education and essay writing is actually quite unique to some parts of the world. But to your point, are you implying that there's some sort of bias in the MW?
No. And I want to be really clear, I'm not saying that. And in fact, there used to be lots of conspiracy theories around that with people suggesting that the graduating numbers were kept tiny to keep the prestige.
Okay.
But when I was talking to people, so many MWs told me how much they longed to see more MWs. They really wanted to widen the club.
Okay, so continue your point then.
So I do think the woeful pass rate was probably a reflection of not vetting candidates properly at the very least, and maybe the pedagogical methods too. I personally don't think that having a low pass rate like that is a good sign, though paradoxically it's certainly given the Institute huge prestige. But, and here I have to emphasise, things have clearly changed a lot in the past decade, and I know they've done a huge amount of work around how they admit people. So the most recent pass rate is closer to 70%. Which suggests they're doing a much more professional job on all fronts. But what interests me about this, though, isn't the pass rate, though I think it is quite remarkable, but that people are so keen to sign up and test themselves against it. And this is what's interesting is this is not the only extremely difficult wine course out there. The Vinitaly Wine Ambassador one is extraordinarily difficult. So I guess it's what you explained earlier about the need for competency and status.
Yeah. So what did you discover about what happened then, back to your article you were trying to write, about what happened to people after they've graduated with an MW?
Well, again, this was a long time ago, right? So I want to be really clear that, you know, my thoughts on this don't reflect contemporary reality. But back then, it depended on where you were in the world. So if you were in somewhere like Britain, the people most likely to pass the MW were clearly the people who were going to be successful in the wine trade one way or the other. And gaining the MW just proved it. So that sort of fits what you were saying, which is the type of people who will, you know, endure this kind of challenge are people for whom competency and achievement is really important. But I should also say that, and this is part of the wine education puzzle as well, is that things have changed a lot in the trade. It's become a lot more professionalised and everyone is expected to undergo formal training. And now for some jobs, like working at top auction houses, for example, of fine wine buying, an MW is practically mandatory, particularly in China.
Yeah, it is. So you've been talking a lot, or we've been discussing, you've been commenting on a lot about how difficult the MW exams are. So I looked up the 2024 exam papers. So let me share an example.
Hit me with them.
Share an example from a tasting paper. So one of the tasting papers, you've got 12 wines that you're tasting blind and you're being examined on. So wines 8 to 12 of the 12 wines from the 2024 paper. So the question was, wines 8 to 12 are all from the same single variety and 5 different countries. So the question was, with reference to all 5 wines, identify the grape and for each one, identify the origin as closely as possible, and then go on to discuss how climate and winemaking techniques have influence the quality and style of each wine.
Okay,
so how would you do, Felicity?
Well, it depends. If I was doing it in that Warsaw office, I'd do really well because they didn't cover up the bottle properly when they were pouring, so I could see one was a screw cap and one had an Italian tax band on it. Okay, so in theory, that could be 5 out of 100,000 wines. But my understanding is that this is not completely random. It's more like a test of logic. So you go step by step, and even if the answer is wrong, you might score some marks for the working out, like you do in maths. So, for example, if it's white and high acidity and it's like this, you know, I'm going to suggest it's an Assyrtiko. And even if it's not an Assyrtiko, you might get some marks for how you got there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But I continue. So they then helpfully go on to list wines 8 to 12 so we can see what they are. And check this out. They included a Pinot Noir from Niagara Peninsula in Canada, a Spätburgunder from Baden in Germany, and a Pinot Noir from the Russian River Valley, Sonoma, US.
Okay, so it's wines that have got just enough in common that, you know, if you don't have the right level of expertise, you could seriously go in the wrong direction. Mm.
Yeah, okay. So that was one of the wine tasting papers. And then on the vinification questions, how about this one? How would you do with this? What are the key factors for a winemaker to consider when choosing an appropriate fermentation vessel for wine production?
Oh, that's easy. So as a wine business journalist, my answer is always going to be whatever is in the budget, which is why they would probably kick me out after the first year.
I'm not sure that would fly as an answer. Okay.
I'll tell you what, I bet you that is how companies determine what their fermentation vessel is going to be. Okay, so hit me with another one.
Okay, so I'm going to try you now on one from the business paper.
Okay.
So if you're a wine business journalist, this is up your street. Do emerging wine regions need international investment to succeed on the global stage?
Well, I could actually give you an argument both ways for the emerging region.
Okay, well, you can give us lots of arguments, Felicity, but go ahead.
Well, no, here's the thing. I've seen regions where, you know, the interminable expat comes back with a load of money and they decide they want a trophy winery and they throw lots of money at it and they do lots of marketing and it does nothing for the region. And then there's places where you find a dedicated winemaker with a vision who doesn't have much money, who just sets up shop and they put the place on the map because their winemaking is exceptional. But the reverse is also true, and I could give you lots of examples of both of those. But anyway, so what do MWs themselves have to say about the whole thing?
Yeah, so I spoke to the lovely Regine Lee. So she's currently MW, of course. So she's currently the managing director at Indigo Wines. That's a UK-based agency importing wines into the UK. So she completed her MW in the quickest amount of time possible, which is 3 years. So it basically meant she passed every paper first time, which is almost unheard of and just a reflection of the superstar that she is.
Yeah, that's really impressive.
Yeah, it certainly is. So when I asked Regine about why she did the MW course, and by the way, obviously she'd previously done her WSET diploma and she was also a certified WSET educator at that point. So she told me that she primarily was doing it because she just wanted to take on to the challenge to see if she could, to the point you were making about how hard
Everest.
It is.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so she's clearly a high achiever who's looking for a challenge. And what did she say about the process?
Okay, so she said in her cohort, so the people who started with her when she started it back in 2015, so there were 12 of them, and she said that they worked really as a team effectively. So they'd meet monthly, they'd organise their own tastings, they bring wine depending on what the topic was, you know. So for example, if they were looking at Bordeaux blends, each of them would write up tasting notes, would then share them with each other. So it was really collaborative to support each other through this really tough process. And they worked together, you know, to support each other outside of the more formal structured element of the course, which she said she found really helpful and super supportive.
Yes, and so I should say something, an addendum to my previously cynical comments, I'm not cynical about the MW because everybody I spoke to who didn't pass it actually told me that the process had still been very helpful in the trade work that they did. So one very prominent European supermarket buyer who buys for a major chain told me that after just attempting the MW, she was much better at making logical decisions that she could justify to management.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And Regine went on to say that when she got to the research paper, so that's effectively when you complete, you kind of have to complete a dissertation, 10,000 word dissertation. She said she found that more challenging, not because of the writing, I should say, of the dissertation. I'm not suggesting that she struggled with that or said she struggled with that, but it was more about the fact that she was kind of working solo rather than having this sort of group to support her as she was doing that. And I know from my experience with working with other MW candidates that the research paper can be really quite tough for that reason.
Yeah, this is on a slight tangent, but I know that a number of Europeans were absolutely stumped by the requirements of that style of dissertation writing. So some of the ones that I know that were successful actually went off and hired tutors.
Gosh, yeah. So I've been privileged enough to support a number of MW candidates over the years who are doing their research papers. And I've been working with them primarily as an advisor on research methodology. So after all, they've done all their vinification, viticulture, business of wine papers, they then have to go on and complete effectively a master's style dissertation.
Mm. All right. So we've done the WCT, we've done the MW. And so we should include a discussion about the Court of Master Sommeliers, not least because there have been two very large controversies there in recent years.
There have, you're right, Felicity. So not all is perfect in the world of wine education. So as our resident history correspondent, run us through the backstory and the history of the Court of Master Sommeliers.
Well, interestingly, it's the US branch that gets all of the attention, but it's another UK institution. It was established in 1977. So in the 1970s, and this actually surprised me, there was huge growth in both wine sales and fine dining, both in the UK and internationally. And the reason it surprised me was the economy was quite depressed in the 1970s. Mm. But it turns out that, you know, that this was growing, and so there was a strong need for more specialists who knew about wine. So once again, the major bodies were involved, the Vintners Company and the Institute, plus the Wine and Spirit Association, and this time the British Hotels and Restaurants Association. The first Master Sommelier exam took place in 1969. And then during the
19...
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It was probably a comet that year as well. And then the court expanded into North America in the 1980s because of their growing fine dine culture, which I'm sure had a lot to do with the Reagan economic boom. Anyway, so apart from that, I should add, and you'll never guess what my opinion is about this, that the final qualification, the Master Sommelier Diploma, also has an extremely low pass rate. There are even fewer Master Sommeliers, just over 270.
Okay, so are you cynical about this one as
well? I really am. And this time I have, I think, a very good reason. So whenever you have something that is very difficult to get and that people badly want, you have an opening for corruption. And this is what happened in 2018. So I want to emphasise that they did do a big house clearing after that. So we're talking about history. Okay, yeah. So back then, a record number of candidates passed the test for the diploma, but it turned out that the exam proctor had emailed information about the wines to at least one person. And not only that, but this same thing may have happened previously. It was such a scandal it made the New York Times.
Yeah, and what happened to the proctor? I can't remember.
He was kicked out. So, but there were lots of other repercussions, like they tightened up the security during exams. But it prompted a lot of soul searching, and they ended up getting people outside the wine trade to sit on the board. They established scholarships to promote diversity and inclusion. But here's the thing, according to the New Yorker, 90% of people, at least then, failed the oral theory exam. That is not healthy.
No, that's really challenging, isn't it? And I remember that the New Yorker story was kind of quite groundbreaking, wasn't it? So share with us some of what they said.
Okay. So again, this is contemporaneous. This doesn't represent, what's
today.
Going on at the moment.
No,
okay,
no, so we have to keep saying that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like athletes dissecting their winning play after the big game, this year's class of new masters gave interviews detailing their strategies for success. 20 to 30 hours of studying per week, coaching from sports psychologists, little quote, mountains of credit card debt. Master status comes with the industry's top bragging rights plus a hefty raise. On average, masters earn double their previous salary.
So that's the point you were making earlier about the salary levels in the MWs. Okay, sorry, I interrupted.
So there is no school, this is still from the New Yorker, there's no school you can attend to become a sommelier. Getting gaining the necessary skills to advance through the court certification is a bit like jockeying for a country club membership. You have to get on the good side of the existing master sommeliers, an insular, overwhelmingly male cohort who can provide a leg up to aspiring masters through mentorship and coaching. The article goes on to say that the grading is opaque and candidates aren't given their scores, so they never really know how they did or not. I mean, that's ridiculous.
So that not getting your scores when you do an exam. Okay. And then, of course, you referenced earlier there were kind of two scandals that have happened relatively recently in the Court of Master Sommeliers, and there was a major sexual harassment scandal. So the Court of Master Sommeliers, again, in the US, and we should say in the US, faced a significant sexual harassment scandal that came to light in October 2020. This time it was the New York Times that did an investigation and revealed that over 20 women had accused or were accusing prominent male members of the organisation of sexual misconduct, which included coercive behaviour during mentorship and certification processes. So horrible stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I know some Master Sommeliers who are wonderful people, but it's the institution. This is exactly the kind of outcome you'd expect under these sorts of circumstances. Very high stakes, very high pressure, very low transparency.
Yeah. And there was an investigation and six members were expelled as a result of that exposure and investigation. Plus they, as you said earlier, re-elected a new board.
Yeah.
But I'd also like to note that the sommelier profession, so we're talking history, those two cases, but it's still quite male dominated. So as of 2025, so this year, no woman has won the ASI Best Sommelier in the World competition.
Yeah. Though an increasing number have come close.
Yeah. So can I do a Lulie sidebar?
Of course.
Okay. So I had the privilege, and it really was a privilege, last year of working with the sommelier star, that is Pascaline Lepeltier. I can't say it. I'm sorry, Pascaline. We'll just stick with your first name. Anyway, so she was, this is how generous she is. So alongside running her amazing restaurant in New York, writing a book and training for the ASI competitions, she volunteered her time to manage the wine service for a tasting that was done in New York for the Gerard Basset Foundation last year.
Yeah, she's a wonderful, you know, person. She's an icon. But the other thing is she's so humble.
Oh, my goodness me. She's just incredible. So the tasting itself was actually run by another amazing lady in wine, Jancis Robinson, and was, and was hosted at Bonhams. And all the funds raised on the night went to the Gerard Basset Foundation, which itself provides funding and grants for individuals from underserved or underrepresented communities to enable them to undertake training and qualifications in wine and spirits. So that's what I wanted to do the segue, because the story, that kind of story loops right the way back, doesn't it?
And Gerard, I should say, who's died, unfortunately, but he had both an MW and an MS. He was
yes.
a god.
He was amazing.
He loved wine education. I think he ran out of qualifications to do.
He did. He was
an inspiration. Okay.
Just on Gerard. So he was one of the few people that got the MS and MW qualification. I actually taught him on the wine MBA, and I supervised his dissertation for the wine MBA, and I also supervised
his... That was from Kedge in France, wasn't it? From
Bordeaux.
Yeah. And then he went and did the OIV, Master of Science.
Which I supervised as well.
Did
I know, he was incredible, which is why Nina and Romy, his widow and son, founding the Gerard Basset Foundation is just incredible, because what it's doing is carrying on his legacy of, you know, and he would admit it, coming from relatively humble beginnings himself and going on to achieve so much. Anyway,
let's talk about motivations, because I actually edited his memoir, and it was very, the humble background. He felt that he'd been deprived of opportunities, and it was one of the things that just drove him to, you know, these enormous heights, because he won the ASI
One more segue. I want to say, and I'm going to get it wrong, so apologies, Nina and Romy, for me not recalling my history correctly. I want to say he entered it something like six times before he won. Was it six?
Yeah, it was something like that. But I tell you, he was such a nice man. It was very difficult editing his memoir, because what he would do is he'd write a list of all of the candidates he was up against. And I kept saying to him, you just take this out, Gerard. And he was like, no, we have to give everybody full credit. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, don't do it.
Education, which is completely appropriate to be talking. So we were talking about Pascaline, and the ASI competition,
but all
which
of these,
is how
all
we
of
got
these,
to Gerard.
All of these great people have that same sort of extraordinary humility. But let me talk something about the ASI competition. So what's interesting is that it used to be that only French sommeliers would win. But in recent years, people from Scandinavia and the Baltics have done really well, which people who participate tell me it's because of the spread of wine education. It's given them access to the same knowledge as previously you could only get if you were in a wine producing country. So this spread of wine education has actually leveled the international playing field and given a lot more people a lot more opportunities.
So do you think wine education will continue growing both in terms of numbers of people and breadth, i.e. geography and reach?
Yeah, I mean, as well as this growing number of enthusiasts, I've also been hearing anecdotal reports of high-level business people who want to know more so they can navigate the wine menu when they take out their clients.
Yeah. So the WSET's journey shows the, we talked about it at the beginning of the podcast, the growth in the last 20 years.
Yeah. And there's one more element to this, which we haven't mentioned, which is that regional bodies have realised they can use this hot desire to learn about wine as a marketing tool.
Yeah. And there are an increasing number of them doing it and actually doing it very well. So talking of fabulous ladies, another one, Snal Holland, who is an MW and a WSET wine educator. So she's based in India. And for example, she delivers the Capstone California Wine Program, which was developed by the Wine Institute of California's Wine Export Program. So basically a way of, you know, teaching people around the world in a lot of depth about for a certified qualification about Californian wine.
Yeah, I think this whole approach is absolutely brilliant, actually. So a number of European countries also offer wine education for professionals and wine educators. And sometimes they do it in conjunction with food training. So people are incentivized to keep learning because they get offered trips to regions if they get to a certain level. So I spoke to some people from Spain last year, some officials, and they said that the more they offered wine education, it was a two-way street, that the more they could see what particular markets were interested in. So apparently Americans are very interested in learning about vinegar, but Germans have no interest.
Okay. I'm not quite sure what to do with that fact. So do you think there's a different approach to education in different places, Lynn?
Yeah, they said that if you want to resonate with the Chinese, you have to offer really hardcore education that comes with a diploma at the end of it.
Okay. So this also functions as marketing for the region, which you mentioned earlier, but it gets wine professionals to pay attention. So I guess that they have a great experience. They're going to effectively become like ambassadors.
Yeah. So this is the thinking behind the Vanishly International Academy from obviously Italy, which immerses people in Italian wine. So launched in 2014, their website says, and I quote, VIA's main objective is to foster a global network of highly qualified professionals such as Italian wine ambassadors and Italian wine experts. In turn, they will support and promote Italian wine throughout the world, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, it's a very considered strategy.
Yeah, it's a really great idea. Maybe we'll see more, I would imagine, from other wine regions and countries.
Yeah, I've actually suggested this in the last year at various keynote speeches.
Countries.
Yeah, I have, because I think it's such a clear, you know, win for everybody that countries like South Africa and New Zealand really need to go ahead and create a difficult course. So this is the point. It has to be really, really difficult.
It has to be
pages on soil types or something, which has some sort of professional recognition at the end.
Okay. So based on your wisdom and advice, Felicity, have people rushed off to do this?
They have not. As usual, as usual, nobody takes my advice. So far they haven't, but I still maintain it's a great idea.
Okay. So are you going to, you maybe should do it and there's some new business for you.
Yeah. In my spare time. Why not? So Lily, what's next for your drinks education?
Okay. Well, as I said earlier, I'm actively looking at wine business PhD programs, particularly in Australia. So I've been talking to some people there about it. But for me, I think I'm going to stick to that type of education, although, as I said, the level two spirits does remain tempting. But I'd like to round off, if we can, by sharing some feedback from another MW, Laura Jewell. And she shared this with me. And I kind of wanted to bring this in at the end here because I think she summarizes really well the motivations we've been talking about behind wine education.
And of course, she heads up Wine Australia. So we are finishing on an Australian note. So I think this is a great idea.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
This is the perfect end to all podcasts.
Okay. So, all things Australian. So Laura passed her MW back in 1997. And when I asked her, she said her key motivations for doing the MW, or the key motivation, was curiosity. So it's not dissimilar to what Regine was talking about as well. And she said that for her, it's all about this magical product, wine, that intrigues so many people. So she said wine is a unique combination of science, geography, history, and people.
So one thing we didn't talk about is the fact that you need role models. We can't become what we don't see. So did she say anything about particular people that gave her the idea?
She did, absolutely. And that was kind of the next thing she went on to talk about, which was that she was inspired by great role models who were MWs. So people like Maggie McNee and Angela Muir. So people like that. And she also said, you know, she graduated from her first degree in classics and was kind of thinking to herself, you know, what do I do with a degree in classics?
Oh, well, it's just the wrong era. I think a degree in classics is a perfect degree to understand the time we're living in, actually. But anyway, okay, so... Yeah.
So she went on to join Waverley Vintners, so an importer in the UK, did her WSET diploma almost immediately. But she said she also did Chartered Institute of Marketing diploma so that she was building her wine knowledge and her more business knowledge.
And so what did passing the MW mean to her? What happened?
Okay, so she said, so Laura said that apart from being a huge relief, she, and these are her words, quote, that she had passed, it took me 3 goes on the practical. Mm-hmm. So she said that. So she said becoming an MW, in her view, has really opened up a world that she would not have been able to have access to the same extent. So she said it opens doors, you know, to visit places like Chateau d'Yquem or to go on MW trips, including unique experiences such as dinner at the house of Robert Mondavi in Napa Valley with him and his wife.
You know, maybe a motivation that we haven't explored is the call to adventure. I mean, the wine world certainly opens opportunities to travel and experience different worlds. It's extraordinary in that way.
Yeah. And just rounding off what Laura said, we talked about, you'd referenced the article that you then didn't write about what happens to MWs and their careers. She did mention that she said it really opened doors for her professionally too. So back in 2000, the glorious Alan Cheeseman, who was heading up wine buying at Sainsbury's supermarket at the time, decided he wanted 2 MWs to join the team. So Laura was one of the 2 MWs along with Justin Howard Sneed that joined immediately. But linking back to our previous discussions, particularly around gender, so we talked about that particularly in the sommelier world, Laura did go on to say, and I quote, in 35 years in the trade, I've frequently been overlooked when in the company of male colleagues on buying visits and tastings. But when somebody sees MW after my name on my business card, attention more often turns to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great that you've got an MW and you get the attention, but my God, I hope those days are drawing to a close, you know, that you get ignored unless there's, you know, you've achieved this extraordinary thing. But I do think it's so great that we've been able to reference the achievements of so many women in wine who certainly did not have the red carpet rolled out for them when they started. So yes. On that note, this has been A Question of Drinks, and please don't forget to rate the podcast and don't write notes about me and my Guinness in the pub. Just give us 5 stars.
Please do, because I'll see them and she won't, and then I can bring them up on
the
next episode.
Yeah, we know who you are, people who write those emails.
You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings as to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche, the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.